Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton on Tuesday, October 19th, a date that is notable because it is the 15-year anniversary, I believe, to the day of one of the most memorable games in Mets history.
October 19th is not a nice day to the New York Mets historically. I believe that they are winless on this day in their history.
No, I think you're actually incorrect about that, because it's a funny thing. That 2006 Game 7 was actually the only game ever called early based on a really nice defensive play. The umpires were like, all right, this game's over, pack it in, the Mets have won. And that's it. That was how that season ended.
Because the Mets have, they not only lost Game 7 of the 2006 NLCS on this day, they also lost Game 2 of the 1986 World Series, Game 6 of the 1999 NLCS. This was the Kenny Rogers walking on Drew Jones anniversary 22 years ago.
And I forgot all about that.
Do you know, could you guess why I know those things, like very specifically about this day?
Is this your birthday?
It is my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. I had no idea that I when I brought up October 19th. It's serendipity.
So it is my exact teenage years. I turned 13 the night Kenny Rogers walked Andrew Jones, and I turned 20 the night Yadier Molina took Aaron Heilman deep. My teenage years were bookended by like the two most difficult Mets losses of my lifetime.
That is tough. I remember watching that Braves game with Kenny Rogers. That was my freshman year of college, like a month into my freshman year of college. And my friend Pete on my floor was a guy from Marietta and a huge Braves fan. And like, it was me and a room full of like people he knew from high school or from the area, just watching that game surrounded by Braves fans. And that was a brutal experience.
I remember I got, I opened my presents before that game started, and I got like a Mets fashion jersey, like a jersey that they had never worn on the field. It was blue with like black lettering, big black block lettering. And I put it on. I was so excited to wear this jersey. And then when Al Leiter did not record an out in the bottom of the first before being pulled, I took that jersey off. I never wore it during a Mets game again. And actually, for a long time, I had a superstition: when I watch my favorite team play something, I will not wear their jersey on TV. Like in person, I'll wear it, but not on TV because of that game. And because of the 2000 Super Bowl with the Giants and Ravens, that also did not work out well.
That Al Leiter outing probably gets overlooked in like the all-time big spot clunkers from Mets starters. Because like the ones that jump to mind immediately for me are Tom Glavine. And this is probably before your time, but this is definitely before your time. But Ron Darling in, I think it was Game 5 of the 1988 NLCS, just didn't have it. And he's talked about it since then. But for me, at 7 years old, I think I've probably told this story on the podcast before. It was just like, that was, you want to talk about devastation. Like, seven-year-old Ted, I couldn't have loved the 1988 Mets anymore. That was my team. And for that season to end that way was like so hard for me to take that I punished myself by, I refused to sleep in my bed. I slept on my floor that night for like some weird self-flagellation for Ron Darling's poor play.
Yeah, the lighter one, I think because he was on 3 days rest, you give him a little bit of a pass, and because he'd been so good to get them into the playoffs that year. But as I have talked about on the podcast, I remember at least once, the Oliver Perez start 15 years ago today kind of goes under the radar as a really great start in dire circumstances for the Mets. Because I forget, I think he was also pitching on 3 days rest because he had started Game 4 that year. And so like a guy with a 6 ERA on 3 games rest in a Game 7 where like, starters were expected to pitch more than 5 outs, unlike this postseason.
Right.
That was a terrifying concept. The Mets were contemplating starting Darren Oliver, who hadn't started a game all season in Game 7. And yet Perez got them through 6 innings and like in a 1-1 game. They should have taken the lead in the bottom of the sixth. He should have been the winning pitcher. And yet here we are lamenting it 15 years later.
I remember that one because for the longest time, remember Baseball Reference used to have the sponsorships on page? Like you yes. can, someone can, and Howard Megdahl, who's maybe a guy you know, a guy I know, a guy I used to work with, and like a longtime voice in the Mets and sports blogosphere in general. He loved Oliver Perez for whatever reason, and was just like the most staunch defender of Oliver Perez, and his for forever he had a memorial to that start as the sponsorship of Ollie Perez's baseball reference page, which of course is still changing because he is still an active baseball player somehow.
I think is he the one from that team? Is there anyone else from that 06 team who's still kicking?
He's got to be, like, you know, unless like someone is playing double-A ball somewhere, like, or like trying to, it was like what? Oh no, Lessings Millich is out. He's because he runs a baseball facility in Florida. He was the youngest guy. David Wright, Jose Reyes, Pelfrey and Humber are gone. Anderson Hernandez hasn't been hurt. I'm looking by the youngest players. No, right. I'm guessing none of these people are still active. Like, you know, by the time you get down to Heath Bell, Andy Chavez, the 28-year-olds, you know they're gone.
I mean, what like you've got John Main was 25 and he's been out of baseball for about 10 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah.
You know, Brian Bannister is working with the Giants as a pitching development coordinator or high level pitching coach. I forget what his exact title is there, but he's been a coach for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And he was one of he was probably the youngest pitcher on their opening day staff back then. So, yeah, it's, you know, I thought earlier in the season, you know, when you think of plan out what you might write over the course of a year, I thought about doing something about this being the 15th anniversary of the 2006 team, you know, especially because they're playing the Cardinals late in the year. That would be a good time to write something. Mm-hmm. And it turned out Wainwright was starting one of those games. So it really would have been a good time to write something. But it was too soon in my mind. The wound was still fresh. I wasn't sure exactly how to go about it. To talk about how a very good team lost a series to a team that wasn't as good in St. Louis.
Hey, you know who was on that team who may very well still be playing in some capacity somewhere?
Was Julio Franco on that team?
Julio Franco was on that team. And like, as far as I know, like at least somewhat recently, he was like a player manager in a Japanese independent league, something like that.
That makes sense. I mean, he would be in his 60s, but he'd still like poking opposite field singles the other way. If he showed up and like pinch hit for the Braves tomorrow night and like lined a ball into the right center field gap to score two runs, that would not surprise me.
And it would be so awesome. I love that guy. Also, I am just learning now. One of Julio Franco's agents, his baseball reference page tells me, was named Chuck Berry.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You mentioned Brian Bannister in his capacity with the San Francisco Giants. That just like sprung into my mind, like maybe they can get Brian Bannister, because we are at the point now where it is clear. And you have been saying this all year. You have been saying since we've been talking about the Mets search for new executives. It seemed like Billy Bean and David Stearns and Theo Epstein were all extremely unlikely to wind up in that position. Their names were floated quite a bit in so many different corners. And now it seems like we have pretty much confirmed. Ken Rosenthal reported yesterday, I want to say that Billy Bean is taking his name out of the race. The Brewers are not going to give Stearns permission to talk to the Mets about the job, and Theo Epstein isn't interested. Is this, because what I'm seeing a lot of is this being spun as like a little Mets thing? You know, like, oh, ha, 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 the Mets didn't get any of these three guys that they wanted to get. But those guys always seemed sort of pie in the sky to me. And also like the same thing that happens every time, or that used to happen with when the Wilpons would say they were going to sell, which is like everybody just guesses the famous rich people. Like everybody would always say like, oh, well, maybe Donald Trump will buy the Mets because he's a famous rich guy. And like these are like three, I mean, not Stern so much, but Epstein and Bean certainly are like the two most famous baseball executives alive right now, I think. And so like it seems like it was always unlikely, and so it's strange to then flip and be like, well, how could the Mets not get these guys?
Yeah, I think it's a weird middle line you've got to walk here, because as I wrote for Tuesday morning, that, you know, judging an executive search in the middle of October is kind of like judging a game in the fourth inning. Like there's still a lot of things yet to happen here. And you know, it's far from over. I think, you know, going into this, the Mets chances of landing any one of these, like each individual guy was less than 50% for that person, by a fair margin. I think Bean was probably the best shot because he seemed for a time at least willing to talk to them, before deciding to withdraw his name from consideration on Monday. But that, like, overall, if you added up the percentage chance that they would get Epstein plus the percentage chance that they would get Stearns plus the percentage chance of Bean, it was probably overall less than 50% that they would get one of any of the three. So it's not a surprise that this is where we are. I think the reason some people probably are jumping to the LOL Mets conclusion is that, you know, 11 months ago, the Mets were on a president of baseball operations search and were taken aback by their inability to talk to different candidates, and that some people did not want to talk to them. And here we are 11 months later, and they're in the same position. That said, what I'm interested in seeing is, the headline on my story is that the Mets are striking out in their executive search, and some people are taking issue with that striking out idea. But you know, when you take swings and three of them miss, that is a strikeout. That is a basic baseball metaphor that I think still applies here. But you know, you're not out necessarily, I guess, in an executive search. You get more than three swings. So what I'm interested in seeing is, you know, for the last 16 days since the Mets season ended, they have been waiting to find out from Bean and Stearns, basically. They were going to wait till the Brewers were out. They were going to wait a couple days after the Brewers were out to make a move on Stearns. They were going to wait until that moment happened to simultaneously do something with Bean. So I would hope that in those 16 days, they have been prepping rigorously for the likelihood of being turned down by both of them, and that they have their list. That their list is not what I think Will Carroll had put out on Twitter yesterday, including like Dorian Boyland, a car dealership guy who has not worked in baseball for a long time. That is not like one of the four guys on the list. Because Joel Sherman had an instantly memorable Mets tweet of, talk to Dorian Boylan. He is not interested in the job. The Mets haven't contacted him. He just likes running his car dealerships. You know, you hope that the actual list of the now, the next tier of candidates, which is still a good tier, you can still find someone good in that tier, has been worked on and is a wide pool of qualified individuals that they have a better feel for whether they would actually want the job or not.
Strong Lou Brown vibes there, like calling a guy out of his car dealership to come run a baseball team.
Cross him off the list then, you know?
Right. Yeah. I would say as a reminder, like when Theo Epstein became Theo Epstein, first of all, he was 28 years old when he took over the Red Sox, which is like, I know like Stearns is a really young guy too. And like, you know, like this has been John Daniels when he got hired by the Rangers was super young. Like it's not absolutely shocking for someone that young to have a job at that level in baseball anymore. But he was sort of the first that I think that set that trend. And it wasn't like everybody knew who Theo Epstein was then, right? Like I think, and I don't have any faith in the Mets to make the right call and find that guy, but like, there is a 28-year-old somewhere with the capacity to be the next Theo Epstein, and like maybe you should be focused on finding that guy rather than the current Theo Epstein.
I mean, there's probably more 28-year-olds with the capacity to be Theo Epstein now, given right. the way things have changed. And
because of Theo Epstein.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that's interesting, I was actually just talking with Alex Speer of the Boston Globe, just chatting with him, and he mentioned how, you know, when the Red Sox hired Epstein initially, that was the winter of 2002, I believe, going into
the 2003 season.
You know,
going into the 2002 season. Or no.
Yes, going into 2003.
Yeah.
And
going into 2003, they made him the general manager.
Yes. They had, the new ownership had come in at the end of 2001. They had an interim GM in Mike Port for a year. And then they did not move quickly to replace him that next offseason. You know, why? Because they were courting Billy Beane in a much remembered scenario. And so they didn't actually hire Epstein until relatively late in that offseason, you know, compared to what you're used to. And so, you know, there are ways in which this can work out. Like, it is more important that the Mets hire the right guy versus that they hire him at the right time. You know, there are time pressures this offseason that don't normally exist in that, you know, you also have to hire a manager. I think those... Was it the 2003 Red Sox that did not hire Grady Little until, like, spring training had actually started? But he turned out to be decent, I guess. Not the perfect right guy. The month of November this year, it's generally not, like, the most active month of an offseason. Unless you're, I guess, Alex Anthopoulos and the Braves, who usually do a lot in November. But this year, with the threat of a work stoppage on December 1st or 2nd, I think you do want to have a little bit more of your offseason settled on November 30th than you would otherwise. But, you know, it's more important. Like, this is, as I've said in other stories, as important a hire as the Mets have made maybe in their franchise history. And they shouldn't rush it, but they should know that there is a sense of urgency in getting the proper person in place. And I sure hope they have spent the last 2 weeks making that next list and starting to vet those candidates to see who would work.
I think that's exactly right, and I think you have to hope that they can, and with Steve Cohen, like, we don't know that he has this capacity. You have to hope that he can, like, tune out Twitter noise and not worry about, like, this sense of urgency that is now being drummed up, you know, by this backlash, right? And because he seems like someone who does pay a little bit attention, maybe a little bit too much attention to what people are saying about him and his team. And so I worry a little bit about, like, well, let's just hire someone so they all shut up. And then it turns out that guy has a nickname like Dick Pick Mick, or he is or otherwise just a, you know, without any illegal activity, like, maybe just not the right fit for the job, you know? So I think you're right. Like, hopefully they're doing the appropriate amount of diligence in their search and will find the right person. A couple points on Theo Epstein that I just thought about or learned briefly from his Wikipedia page. He has a twin brother. So that's just a thought. He's a social worker. He's a high school social worker. Probably a really smart guy if I know anything about genetics and, like, what's, you know, like, how much, like, could you get permission from Brookline High School in Brookline, Massachusetts to talk to Paul Epstein about this gig? I don't know. The other thing is, I'm reminded that Theo Epstein is a guitar player himself and a pretty musical guy, and not to, like, plant conspiracy theories here, but, like, did he write that song for Billy Beane's daughter?
No, I've met Paul Epstein, Theo's brother. Does not look, they are definitely fraternal twins. Is fraternal twins, I feel like it's the kind of, like the adjective unique, you're only supposed to use it in, like, it means one specific thing. You can't have degrees of being fraternal twins, but they seem like less fraternal twins in the sense they don't look anything like each other. There's barely a brotherly resemblance there. So I think you can probably get away with talking to Brookline High School about Paul Epstein for this job. That would be an interesting tack.
It would be an out of the box hire. And, like, you know, a social worker might be the right fit for this. You know, like, you know, like, I think there's a lot of people who might benefit from, like, a a calm and reassuring hand around the Mets organization.
Yeah, that is the exact kind of person they could use. Going back to Cohen, like we talked about during the season, like him using Twitter is not as big a concern to me as him reading Twitter,
right?
Because those are two different activities, and one of them I think is more problematic for a Mets owner if he's as responsive to it as we've seen him be over the course of the year, whether that's talking about Francisco Lindor's extension early, late in spring training before they had agreed to it, and crowdsourcing what he thought the number could be. The tweet late in the year that was kind of like, I know how frustrated all you fans are and I'm hearing it. I think we've seen him respond to kind of the way the fan base is feeling about the team versus the way the team was feeling about the team late in the season. And you hope that doesn't lead him to more rash decisions than he would have otherwise. The other thing is, when you're looking at the guys who are making this hire for the Mets, it is Steve Cohen and Sandy Alderson, and you wonder, Sandy obviously has, I would think, a very deep Rolodex in the game, but I don't know how well he knows younger executives in the game. I don't know how connected he is to that next generation of potential Theo Epstein's mm-hmm. and David Stearns's, the same way that maybe Larry Lucchino was when he was with the Red Sox and helping make that hire. Lucchino was one of the guys who kind of sought out Epstein from San Diego and brought him over. And then the two famously did not get along for a good while in Boston. So I don't know if Alderson has his finger on the pulse of who the good 30 to 35 year old executives are. He didn't know Jared Porter last year before hiring him. And that was, I guess, one of the issues, and that they moved from kind of the interview phase with Porter to the introductory phase. They interviewed him and they introduced him within the same week. And that's the same thing they did with Callaway. And you would think they've got to take longer than that this time because of those mistakes in the past. And then with Cohen, I don't know what his baseball Rolodex is like. I don't know how well he knows the landscape. Over the last year, it has seemed like he doesn't quite know exactly how it works to hire people, because you can't just call them and offer them the money that you want to offer them and say, here, take this job. Otherwise, maybe David Stearns would be the Mets president of baseball operations and would have been last year. So I'm not sure.
He could call me and offer me the money he wants to offer those guys.
Right. Right?
I love doing this podcast. I think I could still do it.
Yeah, I think you can carve out that that exception for yourself to still do a weekly podcast.
Do you think the Athletic would be psyched about having the GM of the president, the Mets president of baseball operations, doing a podcast, like a deeply in-depth insider podcast? I think they'd be psyched.
Until they listen to it and they realize we just talk about this day in Mets history and sandwiches.
We do not talk that much about sandwiches versus compared to my real life. There's very little sandwich talk on here.
I know that's on me because I don't share the same passion for it.
I do have a question on that, just because we're on that subject. I haven't heard you talk a lot about this, but people occasionally ask about it on a question. Is what's the deal with you and Staten Island pizza?
Well, I've just said that I like Staten Island pizza because I was born in Staten Island. My family is from Staten Island. I never lived there. We had already moved to New Jersey by that point. But every time we'd go back to Staten Island, my doctor was there, my orthodontist was there, all of my cousins were there. There were a couple pizzerias that I would try to entice my family to visit. When you're sick, you can really play the sympathy card as a sick 8-year-old and be like, can we at least get pizza? And one of my doctor at that time was down the block from Pal Joey's. Anyone from Staten Island knows Pal Joey's, an excellent pizzeria. It's best pizza in the world, according to me.
I want to say also a Broadway play, Pal Joey,
I think,
right?
I think so. It closed, unfortunately, in, I believe, early 2003. So I'm still devastated by that I can't have Pal Joey's pizza. But that is, I am a fan of Staten Island pizza. Danino's is the other big Staten Island pizzeria that I like and haven't been to actually in quite a while. So that's it. Why wouldn't anyone be for Staten Island pizza? It's a very good pizza.
I'll say it. So I have lived in the New York area for outside of college for all of my 40 years. And in that time, there have only been three times when I've driven over Staten Island hundreds of times, three times I have set my actual foot to the ground on Staten Island, and two of those times I got pizza, and they were both very good. So if I in that I recall, they were both really good pizza.
Yeah, I mean it's. Look, sometimes it comes across as like the Delaware of New York City, where you just drive through it and you never actually get out there. But
it just feels like it's part of New Jersey. It's clearly part of New Jersey. People from Staten Island get very upset about that. It's so obviously New Jersey.
Look at a map. It's a weird carve out for New York City.
Why is that part of New York City? And like, you have to get here by a boat.
a free boat. They don't even charge.
The boat's fun. The boat's fun. That was one of the three times I went to Staten Island.
Yeah, I haven't done the ferry in I think I did it like in 2010 at one point to cover something for MLB.com.
They're constantly running. You just walk up to the. You just walk on.
Right, and it's really a shame that minor league stadium, which is really nice, right in St. George, there is no longer hosting an affiliated team. That was a blow to Staten Island's baseball scene.
I would have to imagine. The biggest blow since John Franco moved out. right, because Franco, was he born in Brooklyn and moved to Staten Island?
Might still live there. Okay. It's the biggest blow since Jason Marquis' retirement.
Oh, there you go. Another classic Staten Islander. We got a question from Joshua Edwards on Twitter, at Joshua1990. He wants to know, I'm not sure I can give him three steps. He says, what's your three-step plan for this offseason to catapult the Mets to contender status? I think that for both of us, probably step one is like hire a good president of baseball operations, right?
Mine is for them to hire you, and then we know the food at Citi Field would be the best in baseball, even beyond what it is already.
It's good, yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, I have thoughts about how to run the base, but like, I don't have the Rolodex, right? But like, I feel like I am fairly convincing. Like, maybe give me a chance to talk to Mark Attanasio about whether we can interview David Stearns to be someone beneath my job as, emperor of baseball for the Mets.
Dictator of baseball operations. Cheap.
I'll do it for way less money than they're going to have to pay Billy Bean. Like, way less. Yeah. I might do it on a volunteer basis, honestly. Because I feel like you get a book deal out of that, right?
Oh, yeah. You get the secondary benefits of what you can make on the speaking circuit.
Oh, yeah. Like, this is an audio-only show, but I'm a good-looking man. Like, I think that I could do, like, I could be out there doing the media tour. I could get some advertisements, right? Like, I'm not, the thing is, like, I have standards. I'm not going to be Mike Trout and tell you I like Subway sandwiches. But, Taco Bell, we could talk. anyway, let's talk about Josh's question.
Yeah.
What do we do here?
Yeah, so I mean, the first step, like three steps, is probably not enough steps. There are more than three they need to make. So I'm gonna guess from Joshua's perspective that like hiring a president of baseball ops, hiring a GM, and hiring a manager are not the three steps he wants to hear. Those are not necessarily the most exciting ones. I would say from a player standpoint, I think a right-handed hitter for their lineup is an mm-hmm. important piece. And you've got to know basically what's happening with Conforto. If Conforto is back, it's a right-handed infielder with a guy who could, you know, because you've got McNeil there, it could be Javier Baez, who I wrote about on Monday. It could be Chris Bryant, mm-hmm. who would fit as third base slash right field for you with his versatility. I think that's an important thing that they need. I think it's two starting pitchers, whether that's Syndergaard and Stroman, bringing them back and then building depth beyond that, or if it's one of those guys and going out and signing someone else, Kevin Gausman or Eduardo Rodriguez or someone of that nature. The third is probably just building as much depth as possible and scouring minor league free agents. And, you know, you want your starting pitching staff. Like, the Mets used 19 starting pitchers this year. So did the Dodgers. So you can be successful while doing that. You can win 106 games while doing that. The Dodgers are showing that you can't really win a playoff series by taking that approach and trusting only four guys. But you need to have kind of, I think it's best for them to go into next season with, you know, David Peterson and Tylor McGill, not as members of the opening day rotation, if everyone is healthy, to have kind of five or six guys ahead of them, and building up some other like good major league starting pitchers who have options that can start the year for you in AAA, because you're going to use most, if not all, of your AAA rotation over the course of the season. So I think building depth there, you know, we've seen them. They were better last year at building depth. Like, they got through that period in late May and early June when everyone was hurt. They have some younger players on the, you know, within view of the major leagues. Khalil Lee is probably the top of those, and he's probably more ready for it now than he was last spring.
Yeah, he had a really nice season.
Really nice season. And, you know, you've got Mark Vientos getting to AAA is probably an option by the end of the 2022 season to be in the major leagues. So you're getting that idea of depth, but, you know, continuing to fill out the roster with the Kevin Pillars or the Jonathan VRs. I think, like, a lot of people have mentioned the idea of trading Dom Smith, trading JD Davis, trading Jeff McNeil. To me, even if you want to replace those guys, you don't need to get rid of them. Like, they can be bench players for you the way, you know, Davis and Smith were down the stretch of the season. Like, they are cost controlled players. They've got some defensive versatility, even though they don't play all of those positions that well. McNeil, the same. You can look at him in the same vein. And if, like, those are three of your bench players and, you know, guys get hurt over the course of the season, they're going to get a fair number of at-bats. Jeff McNeil's going to bat 400 times if he's your 10th guy on the roster. So I think building up a roster where those guys, kind of like McGill and Peterson, are the next line of defense rather than starting the season in the starting lineup could be useful for them.
I think that's probably the right plan, and yet my three-step plan is, like, re-sign Javi Baez, re-sign Chris Bryant, sign Max Scherzer, and then, like, call and bring back Stroman. That's a four-step, and then maybe even, like, make a run at Justin Verlander. Like, I want all the most famous and most expensive guys on Steve Cohen's dime. I think all of those guys will be won't be Class A free agents, right? Like, so to me, it's like blow out every guy who is not attached to draft pick compensation, blow past the luxury tax limit, because I think it looks like they're going to go past it anyway. And you're Steve Cohen, you got $11 billion. You want to make a splash here, right? Like, just like, and because you don't know what those penalties are going to look like moving forward. Now, maybe they get worse. But if they do get worse, then I think you make a big stink. Like, well, wait a minute, we didn't know. And I don't know that it gets you anywhere, but you get to, like, you know, have a big chip on your shoulder for your $500 million payroll, which will steamroll the National League East and win the World Series, and then you worry about the consequences later.
Yeah, I think Verlander is the only guy you mentioned there who might get a qualifying offer. I do miss right. You said Class A free agent, which is what the system used to be before the qualifying offer. I really miss, like, that short phrase that works for explaining that, because otherwise you have to say, like, if the Mets sign a free agent who rejected a qualifying offer, which is just way too long. Like, we should call those guys, that group, that cohort, something.
I mean, you have a platform, right? Like, just call them, just start calling them something, and then maybe it'll stick.
Right. Yeah. I have to think of something punny for that. You know, it's interesting with the starters you mentioned, like, there are a lot of older starters, older, very accomplished starters hitting free agency. It's Verlander, it's Scherzer, it's Zach Greinke, it's Clayton Kershaw.
I mean, Clayton Kershaw won't actually hit free agency, though, right? Like, they'll
I think
come
that, yeah, it would be a surprise if he were not back with the Dodgers, or I don't know. I guess there is, like, the possibility he retires. And none of those guys would take, you know, five-year deals. I think Scherzer probably has the best chance of getting a multi-year deal, whether, you know, but three is probably the max on that. No pun intended. So I don't think he's coming.
No pun intended. Like, no pun intended.
I actually did not intend that one. Okay. I'm always honest when I say no pun intended. I never lie. So I think Verlander is probably the guy out of that group that the Mets could reasonably think about going after, as long as he doesn't have the qualifying offer. You don't want to sign a guy for a year and give up the 14th pick in the draft to do so, even if the last time the Mets did that, they made the World Series with Michael Kadire.
Yeah, but that's still not a good example of why you should do that.
Right. It's not the reason they made the World Series. So I think that's a good idea, is to look at those kinds of starting pitchers. I think there's enough in the starting pitching market for them to find, Stroman is probably the best chance for them to have like that really Stroman and Verlander or someone like that is probably their best chance to have like a really solid number two next to DeGrom. There's the guys beyond that. Robbie Ray is going to get a qualifying offer. I think Gausman's going to be more expensive than you want to pay him based off the season he had, because his second half was not very good. There's enough other guys there that you can fill out your rotation with guys who are, a little bit better than Taijuan Walker was coming into the season with a track record, maybe not quite as accomplished as Carlos Carrasco, but guys who fill out that rotation so that you're not throwing Jared Eichhoff four times and designating him for assignment four times, that you've got a roster that's filled out, that the 10 guys you're going to start next year are 10 major league caliber starting pitchers.
Right. If you enter the season with like six good starting pitchers, that's, people like always get worried about the logjam, and it never actually happens, right? Like if you say like, oh, you can't push Jeff McNeil to the bench, to go back to your earlier point, like, if Jeff McNeil's the ninth guy in your like rotation of position players, he's playing practically every day, right? Because someone's always hurt.
Right. I mean, just think of the 2020 Mets. Like they went into spring training and it was like, ooh, you had what? It was DeGrom, Syndergaard, Porcello, Stroman, Waka, and Mats. It's like, this is six starters for five spots. Who's not going to make it? And then Syndergaard's out for the year. Stroman misses the first start, and then he opts out for the year. Mats was not good. Porcello was not good. Waka was hurt and not good. And then all of a sudden, your number two starter is the guy who was your eighth inning guy in Seth Lugo.
Depth seems like a good place for them to go, but I still like my plan of signing all of the most. I'm serious about is it absurd to think like, what if they sign Baez and Bryant?
I don't think it's absurd. I don't expect them to do that, but I've seen some people, again, I judge Mets fans based off who comments on my articles, and some on Twitter, say that, now like they're not close enough to get over the hump in free agency. Instead, they should take that money and invest it in the organization and the infrastructure.
Nope.
And they've started to do that, but these are not mutually exclusive things. You go back to when the Dodgers were bought by Guggenheim Partners. They invested a lot in the infrastructure. They built up that part of the franchise so that down the road, they were bringing up, a superstar prospect seemingly every year. But while they were doing that, they made the big trade with the Red Sox to take on a ton of salary. They signed some international free agents to big deals, mm-hmm. in like Yasiel Puig and Hyunjin Ryu.
Alex Guerrero and Arisbel Arruabarrena, like a bunch of guys who didn't work out too. They took a lot of big swings there.
I forget, Hector Oliveira, was he, did they sign him, or was that a Braves thing and then they traded for his salary, essentially? That was another one. You can be good at the major league level. You can be winning divisions at the major league level while you're building your farm system. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive when you have the money to do it, and the Mets have the money to do it.
It is agreed. Yeah, like they should absolutely be putting lots and lots of money into player development. They should be making sure all of these guys have good, healthy meals before and after every game, and housing, and like all these things that people have been talking about. Like I also think would just be good for making your players better. Not just beyond the fair play thing, beyond this, like the fact that like these guys have worked full time jobs and deserve a living wage and reasonable conditions. Like I think there's a real case to be made that like if you just make the conditions for your minor leaguers a lot better, then they can put in a lot more work toward becoming very good baseball players. That's a separate conversation, but yeah, I don't think investing in the major league roster and investing in minor leagues, because there's no cap on what you can spend in minor league facilities, in minor league meals, and different things like that. Then there's the baseball teams have the what's limiting them in their spending is this luxury tax, right? Like they're kidding you if they're saying, oh, we don't have the money to pay for this thing or this thing or this thing. They do. And so like you don't need to worry about your free agent salaries when you should be bulking up your farm system.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the luxury tax. It's like the social, like it's become socially acceptable basically to cite the luxury tax that right. you don't have to go over it because, you know, other teams aren't going over it. So as long as most teams aren't going over it, that there's no team blowing you out of the water, you know, like the Yankees of the turn of the century when they were spending, you know, that yeah. when their payroll was 50% higher than any other payroll, that dragged it up for the rest of the league.
I think there were a couple of years where it was like maybe even like twice as much as yeah. Yeah.
So, and that's why, like, the Red Sox started spending, the Mets started spending, the Dodgers started spending back then, because the Yankees had set the bar so high. And, like, right now, the Dodgers are doing it to an extent, but there's no team in baseball that's, you know, there's that, no team that's creating that rising tide to float the rest of the boats when it comes to payroll. And Major League Baseball likes it like that. They don't want that breakaway team setting a different pace for everyone else. That's probably a better metaphor, is like a cycling race. You don't want that person breaking from the peloton that everyone has to chase. They want everyone in the same group so that, you know, it's all the same and no one sets too fast a financial pace.
You can be a hero, Steve Cohen, right? You can be a hero to a lot of people if you just break from that peloton.
I'm sure he's heard that all the time.
nobody thinks of a Peloton as a, like, you apparently know cycling, but like a Peloton is now the thing that comes to your house and has a video on. I don't actually know what it does, but like it's the exercise bike that's all gussied up.
My apartment does not have enough nice windows to host a Peloton, you know, based off the commercials. Like you've got to have a certain kind of apartment to be able to have a Peloton. Otherwise, when they deliver it, they say, no, this isn't for you.
Oh, my apartment simply does not have enough floor space for a Peloton. Like that's a non-starter. I don't have enough room to, like, I know how to play the trombone. It was a thing I did once. I can't have a trombone in my apartment because you couldn't get to sixth position because there's simply not enough space.
It's living in New York.
So you know, and plus no one in my apartment building wants to hear my trombone playing. Tim, we will talk again next week, and probably the Mets still won't have a president of baseball operations.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, they were not going to hire someone before the end of the World Series anyway. There was the chance we would have like a pretty good feel for who it was, but I would still expect this to go. I think the hope is the general manager meetings start on November 9th, I believe it is, that they have someone in place by then. But that's not necessarily going to be the case. It wouldn't surprise me if that's not the case, in which case Sandy Alderson will remain the interim GM at that point. That's not like a hard deadline, but you would like to have someone in place by then, but they might not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully we get closure sooner than later, I guess. But as we discussed at length, most hopefully it is the right person for the job. And whenever we find out who that person is, of course, we will be here to talk about it. Tim, peace out.
Adios.